I wanted to talk to you about ageism in the era of COVID-19 specifically. According to a new report from the World Health Organization, one in two people globally hold ageist views. Those are stereotypes of older and younger people based on their age, and they have long-term social, health, and economic consequences. But there are some generations that get left out of conversations about ageism. One of them is my own, Generation X, or dare I call us the middle-aged. In 2019, we here at The Takeaway checked in with folks in their 40s to see how they were managing the stresses of being a so-called sandwich generation, in some cases caring for their own children while also caring for their elderly family members. And if the midlife juggle was real before the pandemic, I checked in on Twitter this week to see how my fellow middle-agers have been holding up during the pandemic. Some of them said the pandemic had added to the stresses of midlife, while others said the pandemic had allowed them to find strength in community with others. But ageism isn't limited to those in their 40s. Here's what you had to say about some of your own experiences.
I've recently turned 60 and relocated to a suburb outside the Tampa, Florida area. I have experienced tremendous ageism for the first time in my life, and it has been very difficult for me to find work, even though jobs are plentiful. I recently eliminated any information about my age on my resume, which actually got me a call. At one job interview, after looking at the license and seeing my age, I was asked if I could actually walk up the stairs.
Yes, age is a stigma, and both before and after the pandemic. Someone on Facebook didn't like my comment, looked at my page, and retorted with, quote, "First time on Facebook, granddad. Being disrespected is the impact." Currently, I'm working on the nuclear put-down.
When I look back, I realized that I had never met the interviewer or my boss in person before I was offered the job and started. And I wonder how many of them were surprised when I showed up. I'm 66 now. I still need to find a job because I can't afford to retire.
Now people are saying, well, let's get the older people out of the job market. Let's, you know, people should retire so that the younger people can work. But why shouldn't we have jobs? We have to live too.
Once upon a time, I was a showstopper. A major babe. Tall, blonde, lovely, young, everywhere I went, people, well, mostly men, noticed me, how I moved, what I said, what I needed, what I wanted. Then I grew old. I grew invisible. Overnight, I disappeared. No one answers when I ask a question. I enter a room, no one sees me. I don't mind. Now I don't mind, but I'm going to tell you, I did once. Oh yes, I did mind when it first happened. It comes as a shock, you know. You wake up one day and you're invisible. And the transition takes a little adjusting, but now I'm 72 years old and I've had plenty of time to get used to it. I think I've got a handle on this whole invisible thing. Think about this. If you're a woman and you have your own savings account, checking account, if you receive the same wage as men for doing the same work that those men do, if you're able to fill a birth control prescription without some man telling you it's okay, if you're able to play hockey, basketball, or soccer without getting permission, if you're employed as a lawyer, a clergywoman, a plumber, or an iron ore miner, and you can't imagine ever being denied the right to do any of those things. If you can do any of that, you should be thanking an old, invisible woman. But when you do so, and I hope you do, don't make a big deal out of it. Don't draw attention to yourself when you do it, please. We're invisible, you know, and we like it that way.
I hear so many of you callers, and I can identify with a lot of what you're saying. So thanks to everyone who left a message. And remember, you can always share your thoughts with us by recording a voice memo and emailing it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com And though ageism has existed long before the COVID-19 pandemic, sad to say, the past year has exposed just how serious and widespread the impact of ageism can be on everything from physical and mental health of older people to the economy at large. I'm joined now by Dr. Sharon Inouye, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Aging Brain Center at Hebrew Senior Life. Dr. Inouye, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tanzina. Delighted to be here.
Also with us is Dr. Louise Aronson, professor of geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, and Reimagining Life. Dr. Aronson, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Aronson, may I start by calling you Louise and asking you about a new report from the World Health Organization that sounded the alarm about ageism as a human right and a public health issue. Was there anything that stood out to you? I mean, to me, what stood out was that one in two people have ageist views.
I think actually what stood out to me was that that sounded low.
Wow. Okay.
Yes. Ageism is so ubiquitous. It's so baked into all of us, even those of us who do anti-ageism work, who work with older people, that I actually found that to be a low number. It is also one of the biggest, perhaps at this point, especially with LGBTQ rights of the last few decades, the biggest internalized ism. You know, we have all sorts of movements about, you know, we're here, we're queer, black is beautiful, you know, fat rights. There's so many different groups that have said, look, we have a right, we're fully human. And the age movement, despite, you know, the Gray Panthers in the 60s and many other movements since then, is not quite there. And we see ageism in people of all ages, somewhat about the young, but more commonly about the old.
Sharon, I was going to ask you the same, a similar question to help us define ageism, because sometimes when I talk about it on social media, there will be people, as we heard our callers earlier, people who are 40, 50 and older, who are really talking about things like age discrimination at work, et cetera. But then there are people who are under 30 who say they experience ageism. How do we define it?
Sure. Well, the Oxford English Dictionary actually defines it as prejudice or discrimination on the basis of age. And that can occur at all ages, and young people definitely experience ageism, you know, getting excluded from the opportunity to apply for jobs or to do advocacy based on their age. But I wanted to call out how the WHO in their report defined ageism, because I really loved it. And they talked about stereotypes, how we think, prejudice, how we feel, and discrimination, how we act towards others or towards ourselves based on age. And I think Dr. Aronson mentioned that, you know, self-stereotypes or how we feel about ourselves as we age, I think is also a huge problem, thinking that we're not valued. And the pandemic has really shone a light on, you know, blatant ageism and negative attitudes that were openly expressed, that older adults are expendable.
I was going to say, I think that it really does, while there are instances of ageism among younger people, I think where we really start to see some of these more pernicious outcomes is among older people, as we heard at the top of the show. Louise, let's talk a little bit about how the pandemic may have, we know it's exacerbated so many things in this country and across the world in terms of economics, in terms of social issues. How has the pandemic exacerbated ageism, especially here in this country?
Such a good question. I actually give an hour-long talk on this with some regularity, but
I'm going to listen to that at some point because I'm fascinated by the topic.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating. It actually hews to the three elements of ageism. When the term was coined by Dr. Inouye and my predecessors, Dr. Bob Butler in 1969, he talked about prejudicial attitudes towards older people, old age and aging, discriminatory practices and institutional practices and policies that sort of perpetuate stereotypes. And we've seen all of this. One example is that when I give talks, and it doesn't matter whether whether I'm speaking to young people, old people, or somebody, you know, people in between or a mixed audience, I say, what percentage of American older adults live in nursing homes? And I will get answers that can range from 40 to 80%. The truth is it's 1%. So one of the distortions has been, you know, talking about the slaughter in nursing homes as if that's all old people. And it's kind of ironic because people can simultaneously, and this is how insidious ageism is, think all old people live in nursing homes and look at Nancy Pelosi, age 80, up until Kamala Harris's election of as vice president, the most powerful woman in America, now still the second most powerful. They can look at Joe Biden.
Who's in her 50s, right? Kamala Harris?
Yeah, she's in her 50s. Yeah, so depending on when ageism starts. I will say I've noticed in the bathrooms of our institution when one used to be there that there are all kinds of studies. And once you're over 50, you seem to have aged out of anybody's interest.
I'll note that for the upcoming few years that I have left in my 40s. Yes. Thank you.
I'm like, wait, you no longer care about me. Yeah, so there's been that. But there's also, you know, we saw the episodes of clotting in children. And of course, that matters. But it's quite rare. By contrast, we had evidence from Italy and China as early as a year ago, February, and we have abundant published evidence for different presentations of COVID in older adults, including a different threshold for fever. And the CDC, state health departments, and local health departments have not adopted that, although they put on their websites, they have huge sections about children. So the risk for an older adult with those presentations is 7,900 times that of a child between the ages of 5 and 17. So the risk is so much higher, but they have these built-out websites about kids and adults, and they have almost nothing about older people. It really is everywhere you look, and that sends insidious messages that old people don't matter.
Sharon, how does race, class, gender, culture, how do all of these variables factor into the experience of aging in the United States?
Yeah, Tanzina, that's a really great question. And, you know, there's really no question that ageism definitely intersects with and exacerbates other forms of disadvantage, including those related to sex and race and socioeconomic status and disability. And there's been a number of studies that have shown older women, especially women of color, experience more discrimination and more adverse health impacts than other groups. And also disabled adults have suffered tremendously during the pandemic. And older adults are also more likely to be disabled. So another example of that type of double blow that can be encountered due to the intersection of these groups.
You know, Louise, as I'm thinking about the most recent part, if you will, of this pandemic, everybody is talking about getting vaccine appointments. And one of the things that upset me personally at the very beginning when vaccines began to be distributed was just how difficult it was for people who didn't have a technical facility. And again, I don't want to assume that older people don't have facility with smartphones and technology, but some older people just didn't have access to it. Some of them, you know, it was a very confusing rollout, especially here in New York. There were multiple websites. You needed multiple hours of the day to do that. And it felt deeply unfair to particularly older people who may not have had the time or the experience needed to set those up. Is that an example of ageism, if you will? Is that a way that we, particularly during the pandemic, did not really think hard enough about our most vulnerable?
I think so. You know, we have a digital economy, and you're just right. A majority of older people use devices. Do they use them a bit differently? Yes, they are by definition not digital natives. And anybody who says, oh, that makes, you know, your average 90-year-old lame, you know, I feel sorry, because they are creating a future in which when they are 90, whatever the next thing is, they're going to be considered a lesser human. You know, we all tend to do this with jokes about music, et cetera. There are also all kinds of overlapping prejudices. So people who are lower income, and lower income people are more likely to be people of color, are less likely to have broadband access, for example. Rural populations, less likely, the oldest old. Now, one of the great things have been about the pandemic has been how many older people who thought, oh, you know, maybe that ship sailed without me, I'm not going to do it, have gotten on Zoom and done that for exercise classes and socialization. But when you have a one-size-fits-all approach to vaccination, you inevitably leave out people, and you generally leave out the most marginalized. There was a great study by Mary Bassett from Harvard in October of last year, looking at mortality differences in people aged 75 to 84. And blacks were 800 times more likely to die of COVID than whites, and Latinx populations 500 times more likely. So when we sort of talk about the pandemic as affecting people based on age or race, we actually forget the intersectionality that is actually what makes us uniquely human. So I think a single rollout is really problematic. We have also seen in my state of California, it sounds like in New York as well, that the government made one approach, strictly digital, pretty complex, according to most people, and forced counties to do all the same work in each location about figuring out how to deal with populations who are universal, of people without access. And this includes some of the higher risk people like farm workers. You know, it's not just the older people. When you do a disservice to one disadvantaged population, you tend to harm lots and lots of others. I heard about a friend at a place last week in Napa County, which has lots of farm workers. Farm workers didn't show up, and instead of outreach to them, probably in Spanish, they sent out a digital call, and lots of young, healthy white people showed up. And then when there was a line many blocks long, instead of pulling people out by zip code and age, which would enable you to pick the people most deserving, and everybody needed to show an ID, which would have given that information. They just did first come, first served. And that just goes counter to everything we know would be useful. And you yet the counties probably weren't given that guidance.
And to that point, you know, Louise, what's interesting is as people begin to get vaccinated, the elderly were prioritized in many places. They are now, you know, there have been reports about how older people are starting to travel again. Older people can hug their grandchildren. The elderly, you know, brigade it can come to save many of us who are still sort of waiting for vaccines and other things. I think it's a fascinating moment to watch. And as you said, people going on Zoom and really attempting to adapt to this moment. I would love to close by hearing, Sharon, any thoughts that you have on what we need to do as a society to get past this idea that anyone over a certain age is just irrelevant.
Yeah, definitely, Tanzina. I think we need to focus to improve our healthcare systems as, you know, a major thing that was uncovered during the pandemic, and making systems that are age-friendly. And there's a big movement of age-friendly hospitals sponsored by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement that I think would take us a big step in that direction. I think involving geriatricians and people with expertise in aging in helping to find the solutions is really important. At a policy level, I think it's so important to be aware and to include aging on the agenda. And, you know, Biden's COVID Health Equity Task Force does not include an aging expert. There's 12 members, and there's really diverse representation of a lot of racial and ethnic groups, of children, of indigenous tribes, of disabled, LGBTQ, et cetera. But there is no aging expert on it. And also it links with 6 additional federal agencies, but again, none of them tasked directly with aging. So I think that's a really glaring omission, and I'm hoping that something can be done about that. Also, I want to make sure the CDC really includes aspects pertaining to aging on its website. It does not include atypical presentations of COVID, which are extremely common in older adults, as Louise already mentioned. things like delirium should be on that list.
What is it? What's something that we should be doing in our personal lives so that we can combat ageism? I mean, is it really? It feels baked into our culture as people who live in the United States.
Right. I've actually started working on this explicitly with patients because there is fairly good data that internalized ageism harms your health. I was hoping we'd get to this, but I think we're also pandemic focused. And as Sharon and I were just texting that, you know, if we had a few hours or days, we could really do this justice. But anyway.
I want to do this topic a lot. We actually, okay. so feel we will be peeling back the layers here. But for sure, tell us what your thoughts are on this.
Great. Yeah. So there's pretty good evidence that internalized ageism increases all the same stress hormones that lead to accelerated aging in other settings, such as incarceration, such as race-related premature aging. And so there are things like you will get heart disease 7.5 years earlier, you're less likely to recover well after an illness or injury. You have more, you move on with cognitive change much sooner. And there's probably a twofold mechanism for this. Some of this is the stress hormone circulating in your body at all times. The other is a sort of fatalism that leads people not to try and not to do the health behaviors. And we see this sort of playing out in populations that have lost agency versus those that have it in terms of choices they make. There's also, of course, access to healthy food and exercise. But it's really insidious. And when I'm discussing this with people, what I'm really careful to do, and I talk about this in my book, I think I was able to write it because I entered my 50s and I was beginning to experience what you just talked about myself, and realizing that having spent my career thinking about this, I was starting to make pretty frequent ageist statements about my own aging because I'm a well-acculturated person. Mm. And so, you know, forgiving ourselves for that and understanding that that is normal and still combating it, because actually it took me a couple of years, but I've trained myself to be happy about it. I stopped dyeing my hair. And there is a joy in watching yourself develop, grow, and change, and a sort of freedom and pride and pleasure with who you are and exploring that. It makes it kind of an adventure. Now, admittedly, I'm a privileged person, so that makes things easier. I did have a moment where I thought of changing jobs and I thought, do I need to dye my hair? So I think, you know, we have to deal in the real world. But there's also a major contradiction in our economy where we say old people are a drag on society, and we don't want old people to work. And this also flies in the face of evidence, because a Harvard Business Review article some years ago in the last decade, I believe, looked at all the different ways you could have diverse work teams, and an age-diverse work team led to the most productive teams. And I think it's for the same reasons people get dissed, you know, the sort of immature, too quick to act young person, the old person who, you know, has certain insights into things, but might, you know, take a little longer to learn the new technology. Or, you know, we have strengths and weaknesses that are based on age, but also, and this is equally important, based on our generational experiences, because history keeps moving forward. So we literally bring different things to the table. And my sort of last point on that, because I'm taking a lot of air here, this is Sharon and I are both crazy passionate, so she'll probably do the same thing. Is that, you know, when we set the retirement age at 65, the average age of death in America was 67. And now if you make it to your 60s, chances are you're going to your 80s or 90s. Mm-hmm. So we have these extra decades. And I'm not saying I would want to work the 70, 80-hour weeks I'm working currently when I get to that stage. I already feel more tired. I'm 57. But do I want to keep working? Yes. We know that people who work have a greater sense of purpose and self and are healthier. Plus, retirement appears to have been an epiphenomenon of the 20th century. So wealthier people have the option of continuing to work, you know, if they love what they do and it's important, you know, see Pelosi, Biden, etc. And poorer people, frankly, have to survive. So we cannot have a society that leads to, you know, all old people in poor houses, as has happened in most countries across history. We have developed to the point where we don't need to do that anymore.
But we don't need to do that. And yet I think there are, at least in the workplace, I think this plays out pretty pretty often. And Sharon, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because I think there's a sense, as you mentioned, Louise, that first of all, you know, retiring at 65 is a luxury for a lot of people, because of the fact that we don't, our lives don't end at 70, right? So many people, and because of the way American society is structured, are having to work whether they want to or not, quite frankly. They have mortgages to pay. They have, you know, a wealth gap to narrow, frankly, especially if you're Black or brown in this country. There are many things, or a woman or a single parent. I can say that, you know, I, at my age, as a new and single parent, I keep thinking, my God, now I'm definitely going to have to work into my 70s, right? But there does appear to be sort of, at least institutionally, from a lot of workplaces, and a lot of younger employees, I would say, that older folk, i.e. people over 40, 45, need to just get out of the way. So, and that's get out of the way in terms of leadership, get out of the way in terms of taking up job space. And I think that's unfortunate, because it pits two generations against each other. How do we solve for that thinking? Sharon.
Yes. Tanzina, can you hear me okay? There's a huge amount of background noise.
I can hear you fine. Control room, okay. Can you hear Sharon okay? Okay.
Okay.
Yep, you're fine.
So sorry about that. So I think the workplace issues are, you know, extremely important and extremely challenging. And I think there is a huge amount that can be done in terms of retraining older adults, or having them apply their experience and expertise in different ways. There's so much they have to contribute, as Louise mentioned. There's so much that they can contribute. And I think just forcing them out is a very, you know, short-sighted and ultimately not wise decision on the part of employers.
Sharon, isn't there room at Oregon? I think the idea, and I was very surprised to hear what you said about the Biden administration's COVID task force not having someone there who represents, you know, aging, and given everything that we've seen with the pandemic, but also just, isn't there a case to be made for having that type of representation? I feel like a lot of companies are saying, okay, well, let's bring in only young people at the top, or, you know, we'll start cutting people's employment lives off at 40, 45 years old. And I wish we could get to a place where we can value both younger perspectives and older perspectives at the table at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree with that. And there's actually been economic studies done by, for instance, Harvard economist David Bloom, who's shown that older workers, you know, have the potential to bring billions of dollars into the U.S. economy. And so it's not, you know, it's unwise to exclude them based on age for so many reasons. They actually will enhance the workplace, as Louise said. You know, there's better productivity, there's better products developed, more efficiency if you include older workers. So I think there really has to be a change in that. But I think that part of the problem is it's coming from the negative stereotypes that are just propagated everywhere about ageism. And, you know, in the media, you don't often see very realistic or sympathetic portraits of older adults. You too often see them portrayed as, you know, baddie or forgetful, or, you know, not vital human beings. You
or
know,
God forbid, boomers.
Boomers, exactly. And the whole boomer term, right, has become a negative term, you know, portraying someone who's closed-minded or resistant to change. And I think, you know, developing intergenerational ties and connections is so important. And the more we can do that, and the more we can build that, I think it will make a difference.
We should all have friends from multiple generations.
Exactly.
Definitely.
Thanks to you both so much for joining us. I could talk about this topic for as long as I'm sure you guys could talk about it to me. Hopefully we will be revisiting this in the future. It's something that I find very, very important and something that I think this country has to figure out. Dr. Sharon Inouye is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Louise Aronson is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Thanks to you both for joining us about this important topic.
Thanks for covering it.
I haven't experienced ageism yet, but I'm about to be 45 years old. Everybody always thinks I'm like 15 years younger. So I'm sure the years are going to start catching up to me anytime now. And when that happens, the ageism will probably follow. So I'm expecting it to kick in pretty soon. But, you know, I've had a good run, so I have no complaints.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and I am from New York. I feel that I see ageism every single day. As an older adult, I feel that I am invisible to advertisers unless the advertising is for me to get rid of my wrinkles, cover up my brown spots, provide for my funeral, or perhaps get a reverse mortgage. I feel that the stereotype senior is being portrayed as unattractive. That's why we need the wrinkle cream. We're not very well off. Our funeral could possibly be a burden on our family. We fall a lot, we're clumsy, hard of hearing, incompetent, forgetful. We need a lot of medication, and we're very unaware of all of these problems. The message I get is that we are an unattractive nuisance that someone has to take care of. To watch these ads that are directed at me, you would think I have completely different needs than everyone else. I must not shop, buy cars, go out to eat, go on any vacations, because no one targets my age group for those ads. I don't know why our culture treats older adults this way. Everyone ages, we all add on the years, and even the okay boomer generation will not be able to stay young forever.
Want to be a part of the takeaway? Record your take as a voice memo on your phone. Email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com and make your voice heard. Or call us at 877-869-8253.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.